Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Coming up in this episode, I'm in conversation with a postgraduate student who is investigating how podcasts are used in science communication. But first, Physics World's Mateen Durrani is in conversation with Antonia Seymour. She is chief executive of IOP Publishing, which is a society-owned scientific publisher that publishes more than 90 scholarly journals and Physics World. IOP Publishing is a founding member of the Purpose-Led Publishing Coalition of Not-for-Profit Publishers. And Antonia explains why scientists, science, and society all benefit when publishers put all the funds made from their activities back into the research ecosystem.
So we all know that scientific research papers are the lifeblood of science, but where do you go to get your paper published? Do you pick a journal with the highest impact factor, or do you go for those publications that you think are just right for your field? Or should you, as our guest this week thinks, bear in mind the values that the publisher of the journal stands for? Welcome this week then to Antonia Seymour, Chief Executive of Institute of Physics Publishing, who's here to talk about a new initiative that she's spearheading called Purpose-Led Publishing. Hi Antonia, welcome to the Physics World podcast.
Hi Mateen, thank you for having me.
Lovely to see you. So let's start with the basics. So what is purpose-led publishing? What is it exactly? I mean, you launched it in February this year.
Yeah, that's right, Mateen. So very happy to describe it. So purpose-led publishing is a coalition of three publishers. We're all in the field of physical sciences. So the three publishers are ourselves, IOP Publishing, also the American Institute of Physics Publishing arm, so that's AIPP, and then the American Physical Society. And together as publishers, we've put purpose above profit, and we've defined a set of industry standards that we think underpin high quality, ethical scholarly communications. So essentially, the coalition is going to see us working together much more closely to consider the challenges and the best ways in which we can support our shared physical science community.
So what was the need to start the initiative? Because, of course, you know, those publishers are quite well known. Why was there a need now to do this kind of thing? Did you feel that the physics community wasn't aware of the values that the publishers stood for?
Yeah, I think we've all been very successful independently, and we will continue to need to be successful in a highly competitive market. But this is about demonstrating our collective value to the research communities that we jointly serve. And I talked about that competitive marketplace. I think there are different publishers operating in our space, and the fact that 100% of our proceeds go back into science is an increasingly welcome distinction by our communities. Because if you think about it, there are more and more ethical and value-based decisions that we make in our lives, whether that's in the choice of clothes manufacturer that we go to or where we buy our food. And I think increasingly that's going to apply in science. And so for those for whom a career in science is more than just a job, or who are making those brand decisions around those kind of ethical standards, then I think for us, it's about articulating the ethos that we have and that sort of shared purpose. So I think over time, there will be more opportunities to actually serve the same community more effectively. But at the launch of this, it's about saying, this is what we stand for, and this is why we're different, and this is why you should consider publishing with us over one of the other types of publishers.
So do you think this is an issue researchers care about? I mean, looking back to my day when I was a researcher, I can't remember what choices I made about where to publish, but is this a sort of, is it a feeling that people need to know about this, that you want to sort of remind people of the values that different publishers, because often I don't think people know what publishers stand for, who they even are.
No, I mean, it's the journal brand that dictates where you publish, typically as a researcher. And I don't think we're going to change that overnight and perhaps ever. But again, going back to the shifts that we're seeing in the society now, I think there are other factors that are starting to come more to the fore than just scope, the reputation or impact factor of the journal and the peer review process, etc. So By publishing with a purpose-led publishing journal, researchers are advancing knowledge in a high-quality journal, of course, but they're also supporting investment into the research community that they're part of. And good publishing costs money. And as you all know, Mateen, we're in a business model transition at the moment from where in the past people have paid to read, and now we're looking at models where people would pay to publish. And so if you have to pay for that good quality publishing, wouldn't you want to know that the money that is being given ultimately gets recycled back into science rather than going into shareholders' pockets? So we're sort of proudly stating that science is our only shareholder as a distinguishing factor to those researchers.
So obviously, you know, the hope is, I presume, that researchers will want to publish in society-owned journals. Is that the main target? Because, you know, I can imagine a lot of researchers saying, well, I just want to publish in the best journals. But you're trying to sort of get a shift of mindset.
I think it is about a shift of mindset, but the whole ecosystem, the whole research ecosystem is also shifting. So open access, as I just described, is just the start of a larger reform process that is underway, with the longer term aim being to change the incentive structures in academia and to recognise a wider set of behaviours and achievements than just publishing in the highest impact factor journal. And we've seen that with some of the developments here in the UK, with UKRI setting out its vision for the future, with the REF 2029 here in the UK. There's going to be different measurements and assessments of research performance. And I think that research culture shift is going to play to the advantage of purpose-led publishers like IAPP, AIPP, and APS.
Mm. And have you had much of a response from other publishers? Do you think you're going to get other people, other society journals to kind of join forces with you? Is it just purely within physics for the time being?
Firstly, the sort of general feedback to the announcement, and then I'll come on to whether we expand the coalition, but general feedback to the announcement has been very positive. It has generated a lot of debate about the different types of publishers that are out there. I mean, if you've read The Promise, some elements of it are quite provocative. And intentionally so. And I think that's triggered a discussion about whether all publishers are going to be able to survive in this increasingly competitive and fast evolving market, with many assuming that we've come together to actually share costs, because of course, increasingly, we're having to invest in new systems, new technologies, new people, new data capabilities to support this business model transition. So it makes sense for us to share costs. Actually, that is something that we will absolutely consider, but it isn't the driving force for coming together. As I say, the driving force is to set out our stall and say why we think we're different in this evolving ecosystem. So I think the feedback has been positive and has triggered a wider debate about the future of publishers and the value that publishers bring to the research ecosystem. In terms of other societies interested in joining the coalition, we have had a couple of societies approach us very quickly off the back of the announcement. And our response has been that at this point, we're not going to open it up to other publishers. It has taken us quite some time to get the coalition off the ground. And I think what we want to do now is move from the kind of set of words that we've laid out to some actions and some deeds, and make some progress under that kind of coalition banner before we consider adding more members, because of course more members means more convoluted decision making, et cetera, et cetera. And we really need to put some actions behind the work that we've done to date. So not to say never, but not at this point. And those two societies that approached us completely understood the rationale for that.
So I mean, what are your plans for the future? What you've started the initiative, you know, a month ago. What's going to happen? What can people expect to see?
So we've set up regular meetings, and we have working groups established now that are collaborating to look at a combination of different things: policies, processes, standards, etc., to make sure that where we can align. We have to be very careful of anti-competitive rules, of course, but where we can align, we will. We're looking at areas of opportunity around whether it's more effective or more expensive to do things separately or together. So one example, we've already made the decision to attend a couple of industry conferences and then also research conferences as a coalition. So whereas before we might have taken three separate stands, we've decided to combine and have one stand, which helps us obviously get the message across about the coalition, but also it's more a cost-effective way to exhibit. We're also looking at funder engagement. You know, funders are dictating so much in our industry now around the open access policies that they're mandating increasingly across the world. So how can we together go and present to those funders and make the case for supporting not just large commercial publishers, but also making sure that those policies are going to be sustainable for society publishers like ourselves. And we're also looking at greenfield areas like AI. You know, developing AI capabilities is expensive. What can we do together across our corpus of shared physical science content? What new products and services could we offer to our communities, but also other productivity benefits we can explore together as well? And then lastly, but not least, you know, we all spend a lot of time thinking about how we can make science more inclusive, not just physics itself, but also the publishing process, and how can we develop ways in which increasingly researchers from the global south can participate when, as I've said earlier, it costs money to publish, whether it's reading or publishing. So what opportunities are there beyond the kind of waiver and discount schemes that we have in place currently to develop opportunities for that more inclusive approach? So those are the sorts of areas we're looking at. And, you know, hopefully in the next weeks and months, you'll start to see some of the outcomes of those working groups coming out in terms of announcements and developments.
So one final question. You know, some people have criticized, you know, all publishers for being greedy. They just want to take profits. They just want to. And who on earth are you to say that the money from the community should fund those learned societies like the AIP, the APS, the IOP? They should stand on their own feet. Why should researchers be essentially funding learned societies to do their activities when they could get that money from elsewhere? And there've been some people who always got a gripe about publishers.
Yeah, I don't think we've done a very good job as publishers at explaining what it is we do. I mean, the number of times you'll read, you know, when we move from print to digital, you would read commentators that would say, why is it still costing this much money? All you have to do is sling up a PDF. They don't understand all the work that goes into ensuring that that research is discoverable, accessible, citable, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we have to do a better job at setting out our stall and the value that we add as publishers. And one of the things that I've said a couple of times in the last month, actually, on various panels that I've been involved with is, actually, the amount of money that's going into research and development globally now is huge. I mean, governments have understood that science can transform society. And so we need to be very cognizant of ensuring that that research and development money delivers that impact. And that's what publishers do. I'm not talking about impact factor here. I'm talking about impact on society. So with the process of dissemination and the communicating research is an absolutely critical one. And you can put everything in a repository at a university, or you can put everything on Octopus, which is a new infrastructure system that UKRI has invested in here in the UK, developed by academics. You can do that, but does that mean the research can be found? Does that mean it can be reproduced effectively? Is it the final credited, validated version of it? I think that there's a really big piece in making sure that that R&D delivers value for money at the end of it. And so in the UK, we punch way above our weight compared to the amount of money that gets spent. I think it's 2.4% of GDP, whatever it is. But we punch way above our weight when you look at the statistics around the impact of UK research. And that's because publishers have done a fantastic job of extending the reach of that impact into global markets and ensuring that it is built upon in the future. So I would argue that publishers have never been more critical, because research and development budgets are going up, the amount of research being published is going up, validation and filtration services are essential to delivering impact and value for money for those government budgets, basically.
But you often hear that argument that some people say that, well, that's all fine, but really, as publishers, you shouldn't be making any money, because, you know, why on earth should you be supporting a learned society. They should stand on their own 2 feet. Why is my money for my paper being diverted to support a learned society? Some people say that.
I'm not sure if you were in the physics community, we would feel that. Because as a member of the community, you typically are a member of a society. It may be that you're a Chinese researcher in physics publishing in an IAP journal, and so you're supporting the IAP and not your local Chinese physical society. But I genuinely would think that most of the researcher community feel this is a good thing because it is going back into science, not into shareholder pockets. So I think we sit in a different position from if you publish with a commercial publisher and then it goes out of the science system into shareholder pockets. So I do hear the comments, but I don't think it comes from our community. I don't think it comes from the society members themselves or the wider community that would benefit from those societies. I mean, if you take the IAP, you know they operate on a global stage. They may be made up of UK and Irish members, but they spend a lot of time collaborating with other societies and trying to broaden access to physics globally. So I think there's a halo effect that is understood by the researcher community. And yeah. For those standing on the edge, maybe it's less obvious, but I think it's defendable.
Yeah, it's an exciting time for publishing. We had a talk here at the offices here at IAP Publishing about AI and how on earth that could transform publishing and, in fact, how knowledge is acquired. And I love that idea from the speaker about the text being sort of active text, that no longer is text a rigid thing. It's this active, moving, malleable, flexible thing that, you know, who knows where. And I think, you know, I agree with you, you know, we need publishers to sort of help monitor and marshal and encourage ideas and innovate, you know, that absolutely costs money and time and effort.
It does.
So, you know, it needs people with the right heads on there, so you need to do that. So,
And just going back to the society point, of course, one major mission aspect of a society is to advance knowledge. So having a publishing arm absolutely fulfills that mission. So it fits. And that's another reason why I think society publishers sit in a different category in that our purpose, our vision and our mission are all aligned with our society owners or our sister or whatever it is. In our case, we're owned by the society. In APS's case, they're one and the same. Whereas a commercial publisher doesn't have that. They're driven by the share price, or they're driven by the markets. So I do think there's a distinction.
Thank you very much, Antonia. Brilliant to have you on the podcast, and good luck with the initiative. Hope it goes well.
Thank you. I hope it goes well as well. We've got off to a great start, but we've still got a lot of work to do to make it really stick and to deliver the results that we hope it will.
That was Antonia Seymour in conversation with Mateen Durrani. You can learn more about purpose-led publishing on the organization's website. That's purposeledpublishing.org. Because you're listening to me right now, I'm pretty sure that you have an interest in podcasts about science. Indeed, you might have strong opinions about what makes a good podcast and what's the best way to use the spoken word to convey complex scientific ideas. Coming up next, I meet a science communication student who aims to answer those questions. I'm joined by Cora May White, who's doing a master's in science communications at the University of West of England. Hi, Cora May. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Hamish. Thank you for having me.
So, Cora May, you're looking at podcasts, oddly enough, as part of your course. And you're doing a study, you're trying to figure out what techniques are best for communicating science through podcasts. Can you tell us a bit about your project?
I am, yeah. So my working title at the moment is From Hypothesis to Headphones. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to find the best way to communicate science through podcasts. There's been some research on it, but the amount of science podcasts is going up every year, and the amount of research relative to the amount of science podcasts is very small. And the research that does exist doesn't usually study just science podcasts. It studies science videos, science social media. It also rarely studies just science podcasts for entertainment value. Sometimes it's for educational value. So I'd like to get a clearer look at the best techniques to communicate science through podcasts.
And when you say science podcasts, are these, I suppose, what I would think of as a popular science podcast, in the sense that the idea is to communicate scientific ideas to the general public? Or are you also looking at podcasts like this podcast, where the audience, is scientists?
Yeah, so my general aim is to make science more accessible for all audiences, so it wouldn't be specifically for people with high levels of science literacy. Yeah, it is kind of funny, we're science podcast within a science podcast here.
Okay. When you first came up with this idea, I'm guessing you were interested in science podcasts. The science podcasts that you've listened to, do you think they're good in general, or do you often listen to science podcasts and think, ooh, that could be a bit better, and then try to think to yourself how they could be improved? Is that where you got the inspiration for this?
I do listen to a lot of science podcasts. My background isn't really in science, although I do have a really strong interest in science. And I find science really, really interesting. And there's so many barriers for people who don't have an academic education in science to getting reliable information in science. If you're interested in science, you kind of have to trawl through everything you see online, or, you know, read research papers, which isn't easy to do. I really enjoyed some of the science podcasts that I listened to, and some of the other ones I found a bit difficult to understand. But I found it as a really interesting way to learn the things I wanted to learn in a really accessible way.
And recently on this podcast, I spoke to somebody called Frederick Bertley, who runs a science center in the U.S. called COSI. And he was really keen on podcasts because he thinks that they can improve people's scientific literacy. Beyond entertainment or just pure interest, I mean, do you think the podcast could be important from an educational point of view rather than just entertainment?
Oh, absolutely. There is research that shows that we experience higher levels of cognitive arousal whenever we're listening to information through a podcast as opposed to reading it on a website. And apart from that, you have all the additional benefits of a podcast. It's pretty much free. You can listen to them while you're driving, while you're going about your day, while you're working. So apart from the educational value, they are very accessible in multiple other ways. So yeah, I do think that there's a real potential for science podcasts to bring reliable scientific information to people that wouldn't have had the opportunity to.
So Cora May, you're doing a survey of science podcast. Can you talk a bit about that survey? What are you surveying and what do you hope to get out of it?
So what I'm going to be doing for my research is I'm going to be making short, small podcasts using different kind of communication techniques. I'm going to ask participants to listen to the podcast, and then there's going to be a short survey where I try to figure out, basically my aim is to figure out which techniques are the best for creating the most retention of information and the most engagement. So that's what the survey is going to be trying to ascertain.
Right. And when you say techniques, these are communication techniques? Is it ways of explaining things, or is it a bit more than that?
So there'll be different narrative techniques, like uses of humor, uses of hedges, which is words that express uncertainty. There's some research to show that that can increase engagement, and also things like visual elements, sound effects, things like that.
Do you have a hypothesis? Do you have an inkling for which of these techniques is best, or are you sort of going into it with an open mind?
I have an inkling. My research question is just, which technique produces, which techniques or which combination of techniques produces the most engagement and retention of information. There is previous research which suggests, you know, use of humor is very effective and things like that. But I'd particularly like to, previous research does really call for future research to look at audience engagement, look at specific science topics. So my research is going to be kind of covering those areas as well.
And when you survey people, are you going to be interested in the sort of facts, for lack of a better word, that they pick up, or more of a general understanding, or is it how much they enjoyed the way you presented the material, or, you know, just curious how you're going to gauge success or otherwise of a technique.
There will be a portion of the survey that is dedicated to retention of facts, not like, you know, tiny itty bitty grainy details like, when did the host hiccup or something? Mm-hmm. Basic retention of information. And in the survey portion, there will be like a scale, like a 1 to 5. How much did you like this? How much did you dislike this? Participants will have the option to opt in for an interview where I'll have the ability to sit and chat to them and be able to gauge their engagement a bit more closely.
And so your expertise is in psychology, is that right? Are you going to be looking at psychology topics as your examples?
Yeah, I haven't finished creating the podcast yet. I've at the stage of doing the literature review at the moment, and the next stage, designing the actual podcast and the actual questions.
Okay. And what sort of audience or I suppose subjects in this case are you looking at? I'm guessing you're going to get some of your fellow students at UWE to help you out by doing the survey. But are you going to be looking at a diversity of people in terms of age, in terms of gender, in terms of their knowledge of science?
I'm going to be getting a wider pool of participants as I possibly can. I am interested in seeing if scientific background, educational background, science literacy, things like gender and age have any kind of correlation on what narrative techniques the participant feels is the most effective.
And you've got a call to action for our listeners, don't you? You'd like to maybe do a bit of recruitment with Physics World podcast listeners.
Yes, if any of your listeners are interested in taking part in my research, please email me at cora2.white@live.ue.se.uk. Participants will only need maybe about 20 minutes of your time. And if you opt in for the interview, that'll take place on Teams in June. The survey will be going live next month. So please email me if you're interested in taking part.
And I'll put those details in the notes for the podcast. Well, thanks, Cora May. Thanks for joining us on the Physics World Weekly podcast. And I hope your study goes very well and be very interested to hear your results. In fact, we'll have to get you back on now that you've been on once to talk about the results.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Antonia Seymour, Cora May White, and Mateen Durrani for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. We'll be back again next week when we're partnering with IPEM, the Institute of Physics and Engineering in Medicine. And we're presenting a special podcast called Environmental Sustainability: Challenges for the Medical Physics Community. Our guests will be Rob Shooter from the Christie NHS Foundation Trust in the UK, and Carrie Tenderup from Aarhus University in Denmark. And we'll look at how the community can respond to major environmental issues, including climate change and increasing air pollution. The podcast will be hosted by our medical physics expert, Tammy Freeman, and it promises to be a fascinating discussion.
Physics World.